What up, everyone? Welcome to the Smoking Tire Podcast. This week's episodes are brought to you by JB Weld, the world's strongest bond. Listen, if you've been anywhere near car people, you have heard of JB Weld. We have used it to fix things for more than 50 years. The pros trust it, but why even hire a pro when JB Weld's adhesive products make it so easy to do it yourself? Whether it's a DIY home project, an automotive repair, plumbing, marine, or more. For projects big and small, at home or in your garage, use JB Weld. In fact, JB Weld products can be used on practically anything. Metal, wood, plastics, glass, ceramics, and more. Keep it in your toolbox, your kitchen drawer, and even the back of your truck. Speaking of which, JB Weld just acquired Herculiner, the original DIY truck bed liner. So if you're looking for the world's strongest truck bed liner, Herculiner's got you covered there as well. Sidebar, I said I was going to use the Herculiner to paint a fake rug on my floor, and I did. I painted a fake rug in my lobby with Herculiner bed liner and a combination of that and paint, and it's awesome. It looks cool. Go check it out on my Instagram. Be your strongest self. Use JB Weld, the world's strongest bond. It is available at jbweld.com, Walmart, Amazon, Home Depot, Lowe's, AutoZone, Advance Auto Parts, Napa, O'Reilly's, Michaels, and more. JB Weld epoxy products are proudly made in the USA. Yeah, JB Weld. We love them. HelloFresh is here this week, and HelloFresh is delicious. They have a special deal going on, 14 meals plus free shipping. Hear me out. With HelloFresh, you get fresh, pre-measured ingredients and mouth-watering seasonal recipes delivered right to your door. Skip trips to the grocery store and count on HelloFresh to make home cooking easy, fun, and affordable. And that's why it's America's number one meal kit. Here's the deal. HelloFresh cuts out stressful meal planning and grocery store trips so you can enjoy cooking and get dinner on the table in just about 30 minutes or less. I want to address each of those points. Stressful meal planning. I feel you on that. I get into a rut where I make the same five or six things that I can autopilot without a recipe, and finding something new to make from scratch is stressful. Grocery store trips are a pain in the ass. We know this, okay? They just are. There's nothing we can do about it. And I don't like leftovers, so I would end up going to the grocery store every single day for fresh ingredients. Enjoying cooking. Same thing. I love cooking, but the hardest part of cooking for me is finding new things to cook. With HelloFresh, they send you the ingredients, the spices, the sauces, everything pre-measured so you can try a new recipe without having to commit to some giant jar of spice or sauce that you'll never know if you use the second half. It's like you need to buy like a $12 spice to make a recipe for two. That's not good. HelloFresh solves that. Getting dinner on the table in just about 30 minutes or less, I have made at least 15 to 20 meals from HelloFresh, and I don't know about 30 minutes or less. Some are like 30 to 40 if you count the total prep, but 30 to 40 for a delicious meal starting from things are in the refrigerator is pretty good. I am really about these options, right? And they're offering a great, really good deal. Go to HelloFresh.com/smokingtire14 and use code smokingtire14 for up to 14 meals plus free shipping, okay? So you got to go to the website and use the code. You got to do both. HelloFresh.com/smokingtire14 and use code smokingtire14 for up to 14 meals plus free shipping. HelloFresh is America's number one meal kit for a reason, because delicious. It's delicious. And speaking of listening up, Raycon's earbuds. These Bluetooth wireless earbuds are super awesome. They sent me a set. I didn't really know how to set them up on my phone. I literally just charged them using a micro USB in this little case. I just powered them on, activated Bluetooth on my phone, and then boom, they just like connected and a podcast just started playing, and that was it. They were connected, and I didn't really know that I wanted earbuds before until these Raycons honestly changed my mind. Here's why. One, I have big, stupid ears, you know, and those other earbuds that are the really, really popular ones that are like white that a lot of people are using, they're made by the phone company, those don't fit in my ears. They fall out. You know, if I move my head around, they just fall out. And that was a problem when they had wires, and it's still a problem now that they don't. The Raycons, they have multiple different attachments that attach for different ear sizes. It stays in my ears. I took a really long, like 2.5 hour drive the other day wearing them. I did not have to make any earbud adjustments. I put them in once, they just stayed. You get crisp, powerful beats, half the price of other premium audio brands. They look great and they feel even better. They come in a whole bunch of different colors with customizable gel tips, like I just said, for a comfortable in-ear fit. Raycons are built to go wherever you go with quick and seamless Bluetooth pairing and a compact charging case. Now that they're paired, literally every time I take them out of the case, I just put them in my ears, I turn them on, they're paired. That's it. They're done. And then I put them in the case and they automatically power off. Done. Easy. Listen up. Raycon's offering 15% off all of their products for my listeners. And here's what you have to do. Go to buyraycon.com/smoking. That's BUYRAYCON. Buyraycon.com/smoking. You get 15% off your entire Raycon order. And it's such a good deal, you'll want to buy a pair and a spare. That's 15% off at buyraycon.com/smoking. Buyraycon.com/smoking. And of course, this show is brought to you by our friends at Tradecraft Farms, purveyor of the most delicious, scrumptious, delightful THC and CBD products that exist in California. If you're here in the civilized world, ask for it by name at your legal dispensary or visit one of their brand name dispensaries in the Southern California area. If not, if you're not in California where, you know, we can just have these things, then give them a follow on Instagram, Tradecraft Farms. Tell them your boy, the Smoking Tire, sent you. We appreciate it. Just make us look good. That's all. Just make us look good for the sponsors. We don't ask for much. Just make us look good. All right, folks, on this episode of the show, Ariel Adams from A Blog to Watch is here. We are talking about watches, but honestly, we talk about a lot more than that. We talk about cars, we talk about life, we learn about the watch industry, we talk about people and human behavior. It is a show that was supposed to be about watches, but ended up being about kind of a lot more. Ariel Adams from A Blog to Watch on the Smoking Tire Podcast.
It was fun, random shit. We're talking. Wait, okay, it'll so going back to the desert in Dubai, was there a falcon involved?
Like falconry?
Yeah.
Like the bird, mm-hmm. Or a Ford Falcon?
No, like the bird, and the glove. You know.
No, but I did see some. No, I did see somebody with a falcon action.
See
over there. Yeah.
You can't go into a luxury experience out in the Dubai desert without a falcon appearing.
Now that you mention it, you know where I saw the fucking falcon? The airport.
What do you mean?
The guy with the falcon was at the airport.
Like the glove, and he was holding it?
Like, yeah, but like he was traveling with the bird
they
somewhere.
Make amazingly intimidating pets. Yes. No one screws with a falcon person.
Yes, they do. It's fucking funny.
Can you imagine taking one home to your cats?
Oh, my God,
the exchange,
dude.
Just the eye contact that would happen. It'd be a lot of mutual respect, right? But not a lot of comfort.
Like, all right, listen, who owns this place? You own this place. I'm pretty sure you own this place, but like, listen, I own it now.
Falcons are very commanding when they enter a room, you know? Because they're usually outside, so when the inside presence, it's basically like a peacock.
Yeah, but like a violent one.
I think peacocks are actually violent too. They're predators. They're predators, yeah.
Well, they're so pretty, it's okay, give them a pass.
There's like an epidemic of them in like part of California. No, because in the late 1800s, it was very fashionable for a period to have peacocks, and so some of them were brought here.
That makes a lot of sense.
And then they went, you know, they got wild.
Yeah.
And some people love them because they're pretty, but they also, some people think that they, you know, they defecate everywhere and they're like a nuisance because they have that shrill cry. So there's like two camps of neighbors. There's like the pro peacocks and then there's the anti peacockers, and it's like this whole big political thing.
Is this still a battle that's raging?
This was just in the paper, like, in the last few weeks.
Oh, I thought you were just talking about something that was, like, back in the day. This is right now?
Yeah, the vestiges of the peacockery.
Is there a dollop about this? We need to find out.
And by the way, peacock only stands for the male. Oh, what's the female's a, what's a peahen.
Oh, well, that...
I had to learn all
about
this.
Now that you mentioned that, that makes a whole lot of sense.
I know, right?
And do they do the thing, too?
No.
They don't, right?
No, it's just
they
the
just
males.
Look like a fucking chicken? A
yeah.
A peahen is just a chicken?
They're brown.
Basically?
They're not even attractive. They just look like weird,
that's
big chickens.
That's so funny.
Yeah.
And no one just, no one gives a shit anymore.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, we gotta keep one around.
I'm not even sure where they're originally from. I think, like... I don't know, the Indian subcontinent, maybe? I have no idea.
Oh, wow. All right. Looks like we're learning some shit today about birds.
Yeah.
Fucking A.
We can talk about watches now.
We can. You're double fisting, so, I mean, you're ready. You're ready to.
You know what,
like,
the sad thing
is? I have the car version of your shirt, too. You know that? I have a shirt that says, like, famous racing driver, but the famous is crossed out.
Really?
Like, that's literally the watch version of the same shirt.
We came up with this. We thought it'd be funny terms. We started putting it on stuff.
It is non-amateur horologist,
yeah.
Which is like a professional, basically. What's the difference between non-amateur and professional?
I think the idea was to sort of catch your attention, to read it, to be like, what are they trying to say? Because it's sort of like a funny statement, right? Because, okay, first in the watch space, there's always this weird like combat of like, who's the most knowledgeable watch guy in the room? There's this, yeah. This weird like... thing about who knows the most, whose opinion's the most. I find it hilarious. So the joke is like, oh, I'm not an amateur. I really know what I'm doing. So it's really not about being a professional, but it's about not being a novice. And then the term horologist, which I think is misapplied most of the time. You always hear this, oh, I'm a horologist. You appreciate the study of time? No, like you're into watches. I don't even think horology
being a watch.
If you're
a watchmaker, you can be a horologist.
Sure.
Other than that, I don't know.
But the guys like to use this term, and the word kind of whore is in it, so people are like, I have to do with women? So it's just kind of comedy all around.
I don't think I can imagine like referring to myself ever as a horologist.
But some of these guys do. I swear, I see them there, and they sound all proud about it. Like they don't want to say watch collector. They don't think that's cool enough. So I really fancy myself a horologist.
I thought car people were really awkward until I met watch people.
And then did that make
watch people
car people seem
more,
really approachable?
Yeah, it makes car people seem really balanced. No, car people are like, the problem with car people is that they wrap their entire personality in the car. Like, there's some people that do that with watches, too, like, on Instagram. It's, like, fan pages and whatnot. But, like, your whole personality is
like
wrapped around.
Like, that defines
around.
You.
Yeah, and a car. Like, it's not even, like, Mustang fan. It's, like... 1995 Cobra Mystic guy.
That's their avatar.
You're committed to that one thing forever.
Okay, so you have that in the watch space, and I actually wrote about this a while ago because I thought it was so interesting that people would have these Instagram accounts, and the name of the account referred to them as being like a watch enthusiast.
Mm-hmm.
Like nothing else about them was important, husband, father, traveler, worker, but that they were a watch person. That was like the defining characteristic of their major social media profile. And I see the exact same thing with cars. It's a weird thing because for me, like my private, you know, Instagram account, it's just, you know, it's Ariel to watch. Like we have the blog to watch one. Like should I make it more, is it not watchy enough?
Well, I mean, I am really stubborn about that kind of thing because I think that I personally like to follow humans on social media, and
what a thing.
Other people like to follow topics.
Right.
And so people like to say to me all the time, like, I come to you for this. And my response is like, well, that's not really my problem, is it? Why you come? Because I was doing what I was doing, and then you ended up here, and I'm just going to keep doing what I was doing. But at the same time, I kind of like... I can understand why if someone wants to follow me because they like the way I review cars and they get pictures of cats and food and watches, they might be like, that's not why I came here. So, like, I think if you want to experience maximum growth on your social media, you probably should have an Instagram for each topic.
That's a lot of Instagramming. Well, here's what I'm hearing.
That also, your life would suck, by the way.
It would suck.
That's the
You're using Instagram like... Again, like the new MySpace kind of, and other people are using it as an alternative to magazines, and it's sort
yes.
of like two slightly different reasons for being at the same place.
Mm-hmm.
And I completely understand what you're saying. I prefer the magazines because, you know, that's what we do. We're in a sense publishing professionals, and I grew up reading car reviews, computer game reviews, computer reviews, camera reviews, And I recognize the value of this sort of professional set of people that knew these objects well enough to speak about them intelligently. And yes, you could have conversations with your buddies as well, but ultimately there's that person that sits there and sees all the new computers and cameras, listen to them. And that's sort of what we are. And that's a lot of value. We are exposed, you to cars, me to watches. Of course, there's a lot of sort of overlap. But we know more about these things than the average person that we could give good advice. And we are professional advice givers. And that's where I see ourselves as. But you, if you democratize that too much, like on Instagram, you have people giving advice that just don't know what they're talking about.
Sure.
I worry about that.
I try not to make my advice too personal.
But you give good advice.
I'd like to think I do, but I feel like I'm asked to give advice without knowing the human really often. And the same thing can happen with watches. I just read, I forget, somebody wrote a good column for something about how hard it is to give watch advice and to an individual.
Yeah.
And like, that's why I kind of like, I can tell you how this car drives, but like, I can't tell you like what you want from a car.
Because taste is so personal.
Right, right. And then, and people end up falling in love with something that it's like, all right, well, here's this car, and it's a V8, and it's rear-wheel drive, and it's a manual transmission. Like, are you looking for a car that is a V8, rear-wheel drive, manual transmission? And then they'll be like, oh, I really like how the wheels look. I'm going to buy that. Just because they fall in love with something that's not objective.
They're coming to you, and they're just, the problem is they're asking the wrong question. They should be asking, they're like, hey, Matt, how do I truly appreciate a car so I can fall in deep car love?
What they're really doing is like, it's like you going up to your buddies when you meet a new girl and going, she's hot, right? You guys think she's hot, right? It's like literally that's what they want.
Dude, I'm not dating
you.
You just want everyone else, the guy,
to validate that the choice you made is okay.
Because you're afraid to make decisions. And these days I get it because we're like, society is very cruel to people that make poor decisions.
That's fucking
true. It's so
unfair. It is. Especially like, people who make poor decisions who otherwise are like reasonably successful in life.
It taints everything, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, especially, you know, if you have some privilege and you make a poor decision, then people just can't wait to like fuck you.
Are you thinking of any specific examples?
Listen, I mitigate this by diving on every one of my poor decisions. Because I have found that being happy is much more important than being right. And the less I give a shit about being right, the easier it is for me to be happy.
This is becoming a marriage advice conversation.
Bro, I mean, that's yeah, pretty much.
It's good advice, though.
Yeah, I can't give a fuck about that anymore. It's great not to.
It's kind of freeing once you get there.
It's like
a little bit,
better
yeah.
to be peaceful than proper.
Yeah,
yeah,
totally.
It, there's value to it. I remember my grandfather says to me, I mean, when he was alive, and he told me as a kid, so I was like, I didn't know what it meant, but he basically told me the equivalent of like happy wife, happy life. And he would say it a bunch of ways, like, she's always right. And I remember as a kid being like, no, she can't always be right. But now I'm realizing, well, it is quite
can't
a good
even,
policy.
That's a choice.
Can't even yeah. when she can't. Yeah.
Yeah.
So,
we
the
both
watch.
Got, we huh? both got Bremonts on.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Which one is that one? The ALT one something something?
You know,
it's
this
black.
This is, they had a sort of this program where you could customize.
Oh, is this the MB? This is a custom MB2?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, shit. Yeah, I saw this.
So I wanted to do the weirdest colors I could find.
Black and blue. Black and purple.
So yeah, blue dial, purple aluminum ring, black case.
It is interesting. It's cool they let you customize it. They literally let you configure it however you want like this?
Yeah, so they have a program like on their website where you can choose certain options.
Now that is cool.
Yeah,
I mean that you can get. Oh, you know, a watch is it's an expensive object, and when a brand, you know, like it could be news when a brand comes out with a new color. You know what I mean? So the fact
well,
that
they
like,
think it's news.
Well, I right, they make news of it. You know what I mean? But like the you know, it's not cool that you can. It's not. Excuse me. It's not common that you can configure a watch in the same way you can a car.
Well, they're doing it more and more now because a lot of these, you know, they have sort of a modular construction. And rather than guess what the market wants, they're just like, well, the market will just tell us what they want. And I like it when there's enough options, but I hate it when they're like a truly personalizable experience with like three dial colors. They're like, really, guys?
Yeah, no, you need to have like a lot of options.
Yeah,
to
like there's a configurator, which is great, but that's very different than true personalization.
Right, I agree.
A small set of options is not personalization.
Personalization is like RGM offering like different options within their movements.
Just the deeper options that allow you to have something that someone else doesn't have, where you get to have a sense of your taste.
What about the Porsche design GT3 chronograph that matches the car? Are you about that life?
I mean, look, I love Porsche design. They're really trying. But I feel like sometimes they put so much effort into coming out with services, and they're like, did you just ask anyone in the market if they wanted that? Like, just ask five, like, 911 owners, are you obsessed with having a watch that matches your car? And just see what they say.
That's fair.
You know?
That's fair.
Like, just focus group more things. If the luxury industry actually focus group things, I just feel like there'd be so much cooler stuff. So much cooler stuff.
My wife runs focus groups. She's an expert in research.
So does she say the same thing?
She does say that a lot of things come out not fully researched, and it is really, really good. I got to help her with a project. I won't say who it's with. But it
What'd
was
you do?
I can't. I'll tell you off show. I can't say what it was.
But what was like the action you took?
It was car. I helped her
car-related?
Gather some people, people of influence. Jesus, Zebby. People of opinion and influence to provide their opinions for a car company on some options for new product that they're working on, and after the work was done. We got a call from them later that the product launch was canceled.
Whoa.
And the whole product was being reworked and the car was going to have substantially higher performance before it actually hit.
So this sounds like a great dinner party.
It was good. It was good. I felt good about it. I was like, wow, that's
the best
fucking
outcome.
Awesome.
So that's what the executives are afraid of.
Probably.
That's why they don't do it, because they know that their dreams will be dashed.
What is this crazy thing you just gave me? This is called Crude.
Crude.
What's a Crude watch?
Wow,
it's fucking heavy.
It is. It's actually sterling silver.
Oh, really? That's why it's so heavy. And these are these diamonds or is those CZs in there?
No. So those are sapphires. They can come with diamonds. I personalized that dial because there's a gradient. So you see the stones, they get darker towards the top, and then they get lighter.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I'm colorblind, so I had to kind of look at that real
quick.
So this is interesting.
This is from
hang on, Jay. Hang on. Let me get you a clean here.
This is from a cool guy named Greg, who is a German gentleman that moved to Ibiza. And this is, you know, this is
definitely a watch for doing drugs in Spain.
this is what I want to talk about the watch world for a second. This is a good story about this watch. This watch is a manifestation of one man's dream to make something that hasn't existed yet. And guys like you and me love this thing. It doesn't matter what it is. When someone goes and makes this new thing that hasn't existed yet to their specification, that goes all out. They had a manufacturer location, you know, in Germany. Each one was sort of made one of a kind. It is a cast case, which is a sort of very primitive way of producing these things, but it has this sort of cool look.
Mm-hmm.
I just love how sometimes you can capture a whole lifestyle and personality in one design. And that's something that...
Was this the first sterling silver watch?
No, this is a new watch.
No, I know. So what has not ever been done before about this?
Okay, well, it's obvious it's a new brand, new shape and all that thing, but the idea that there's a cast sterling silver case in a luxury watch... I don't think that's been done.
Okay, so yeah, it's like I said, this is the first time it's been done.
The dial
so yes.
is also cast sterling silver.
Oh yeah, so it is cool.
Yeah, and it's interesting because it's sort of, you know, sterling silver patinas, similar to the way bronze does, and bronze is a very popular material right now in sort of the watch space, and people love this idea of these materials kind of developing an aged look over time, and you can just, you know, you can polish it with the right chemicals and bring it back. Custom strap, just a turn of movement. Just
it's got like little stones around the winding crown too, huh?
Yeah, the thing
crazy.
Is they can put stones in all different parts of the watch there.
So I just got to play with for like 5 minutes the new Tudor black bay that's also that's silver.
Okay.
I don't know if it's sterling silver, but it's some kind of silver. What's the
It's 925.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It felt nice.
Yeah.
It didn't feel much heavier than stainless steel.
It's
although
not a very
that
big
was,
watch.
Yeah. It wasn't very big.
Yeah.
This is heavy. Heavy, like almost like you know white gold levels or bronze. Like kind of.
It's a
heavy.
Very you design.
It kind of is. I mean, it looks
Can
like
you put
it's,
it on. I want to see it.
It
on
looks
you.
Like a Panerai inspired kind of case, maybe.
Yeah.
I don't know about the strap. The strap is a little...
The strap is cool, a little growing, yeah.
Strap's a little Northern Italian for me.
Oh, it looks cool. Yeah.
If it was one of my Bosporus leather straps, maybe. But it's a nice case, though.
Isn't it neat?
What does this thing go for?
A little bit over 12,000 euros.
Oh, okay, yeah. So not cheap. But it's cool
for what it is. Honestly, it's
cool.
It's not crazy.
No, it's cool. I like that he's. I like that they're doing it.
I mean, what's the equivalent amount going to get you in a Panerai? Something
a
probably
really nice Panerai.
Really?
12,000 euros? Yes, that gets you a really nice Panerai.
I mean, but the Panerai is just there's so many of them out there. You
True.
Know, it's not original. It's not.
You know,
that
I love
interesting.
Erica's original straps, but I always have a problem getting this hook part on.
You are not the only one.
Really? I'm not. It's a common thing because I always assume that when it comes to anything mechanical or like this, that I'm just stupid.
No, I judge straps based upon how long they take to put on and off.
It's a good one. Like, this is very comfortable once
it
it's
is
on,
once
though.
You get it on.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
There's some of those rubber straps where it's like so sticky and like getting through that loops takes like 8 minutes. Yeah. I just never like screw it. I'm never going to wear this one again because there is that rubber that's very smooth that
yeah.
doesn't like stick like that. And then there's the
different
cheap ones.
Different kinds
that does.
Of rubber. Yeah.
So many kinds of rubber, and
there
then
are.
The synthetic rubber.
And different kinds of leather.
That's a whole even other conversation.
There's a whole, like, I hate genuine leather so much.
You hate genuine leather?
Yeah, because it's supposed to sound like it's the nice leather, but it's actually the shit
leather.
Oh,
put
it's
it on there?
Actual genuine, yeah, when it's stamped genuine leather.
I want to know when that practice started. Like, what were people afraid of? Was there, like, a fear? Like, oh, my God, I might be... Because these days, people want to wear fake leather. That's the trend now.
I
so
know.
When was the
they
opposite
They should change
true?
The branding of genuine leather to, like... Minimally leather.
Baby
this
leather?
Is like, yeah, this is like probably not leather.
Manufactured but, leather? I yeah. don't know. What do they call it?
Engineered leather?
It's you know, I think this is one of the reasons that people like watches as a hobby because it's so stable. Watches do the same thing. I mean, in culture today, so much of our norms have been flipped upside down from what we were used to just a decade ago. Yet in the sort of these hobbies like cars and watches, yes, things change. But the sort of the basic elements of it all are consistent enough that we're like, oh, okay, at least this place isn't weird. I think that's a big deal.
I kind of agree. I mean, the mechanical devices, you know, are familiar. You know, when something happens, like with my old Ferrari or something, like I can't fix it because I'm not a mechanic. But like the problems are familiar. You know what I mean? It's like,
yeah.
Oh, this thing is old and worn out, and we're going to put a new one in, and, like, that'll be cool. Okay.
There's a clear solution.
Right, right. But, like, my wife is driving this electric Ford Mach-E, and she just sends me video of, like, the screen, the tablet screen, like, completely freaking out. Like, I have no idea how to deal with that. Like, I'm sorry. Like, no, totally unknown, uncharted territory.
It scares me how the unreliability of consumer electronics that the industry has forced us to deal with over the last 20 years is now entering the vehicle market. Like, it's one
yeah.
thing for your mobile phone to, like, crash and not do anything. But for your car,
yeah.
like, we routinely release software that is not ready because that's just the way we do things now.
Yeah.
And it used to be that, like, the companies yeah. would really put a lot of effort into quality control because once on the market, you can't just do anything about it. Now it's like, we have a deadline.
Yeah.
You know, so
no, absolutely. Unfortunately, the software with the Ford, the car I dropped off at the dealer 6 hours ago, and it's
okay.
ready for pickup immediately after the show.
Well, they just unplugged it and plugged it back in, right?
Dude, they hard downloaded new software. They couldn't do it over the air, and it was apparently like a huge update, and apparently it's good now. Seriously.
How reassuring.
I don't know, but I will say it's never affected anything about the operation of the car. I'm talking about, at absolute worst, it's left you stuck on one radio station until you restarted the car.
I mean, you're right. Like, I mean,
but it makes you think of what could happen because, like, the
yeah.
drive modes go through that screen too. You know what I mean? Like, it didn't go wrong, but, like, makes you think that it could.
I don't know. I worry about the future where automobiles are no longer driven by humans, but sort of portable living rooms. And we talked about this. I worry about what human life is going to be like without most people having a driving skill. Because a driving skill, I think, does a lot of great things for you. It's good for reaction times and motor skills and being able to like move things around, spatial intelligence. When your skills then become how to, I don't know, entertain yourself while you're moving from point A to point B, what does society lose? I think it loses something.
I think, well, the decline of our like cognitive abilities is well documented. But yeah, I mean, the more the car patchwork fixes little, not humans' inadequacies, but humans' laziness. You know what I mean? Like, the more the car solves for our laziness, the more enabled we will be by the car solving for our laziness. But the problem is, the car is and technology and sensors and all this stuff is so bad at getting the rest of the way there that it will be just good enough to make us worse, but not good enough to save us when we rock bottom.
Yeah, I mean, we just have to find some other skill, because I think the future is, and when our lifetimes, they're going to be cars sold with no steering wheel at all.
I'm not sure that I'm right in the middle right now of this great podcast. You know Adam Conover? Adam Ruins Everything. Remember that show?
Yeah, yeah.
I think it's still on, actually. I hope he never hears me say that. But I love Adam Ruins Everything, and he has a podcast, and he did with Dr. Missy Cummings, who's going to be on our show in a couple weeks. And it's basically about how we routinely give sort of this credit of inevitability to certain technologies when the evidence shows that we shouldn't be doing that. And fully autonomous cars, I believe, especially privately owned fully autonomous cars, are part of that sort of false sense of inevitability.
Is it like the driving technology car? Like, I'm sorry, the flying car? Like,
same thing. Same yeah. thing. Exactly.
The like inevitably. It seems like it would make sense, but we don't know all the real hurdles.
Yes, 100%. 100%. And she is a professor of human automation interaction at Duke and is heavily involved in AV research and knows all the hurdles. And she's like, yeah.
We're a bit like overzealous. Like we think that we're somehow close to like artificial consciousness and people don't really know what AI even stands for. We're so far away from it, it's not even funny.
Right.
We should be putting all our effort into the hardware. Like the robotic bodies and hands that can do all this stuff. Like, we're so focused on the decision making. Just leave that to humans for now. We're still way, way better at that.
Yeah.
But work on the hardware. And I always thought the watch industry and the robotics industry could work hand in hand because they're experts at micro manufacturing.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, like a lot of these robots and things, they might have super sophisticated software, but they're made out of like, you know, fancy Lego sets.
Yeah, yeah. They still need like super fine machinery work.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what like my favorite thing is about a lot of watches. Like when you start getting to super complicated watches that have like, you know, 500 plus pieces or whatever.
Some of them have thousands of parts.
I know. It's just when you see like the grand complications that are just like that super exploded view where it's like there's 1600 parts in this thing that's like this big, like what the fuck?
Well,
like,
get this. The people that have to put them together, they can spend months. Imagine putting together like a puzzle set for months. Like that's all you did.
Yeah.
And like you could put it all together and it not work, and you're like, well, okay, now I have to spend a few weeks carefully taking it apart, then troubleshooting and putting it back together. And I think a lot of these watchmakers have to live in rural parts of the world. Otherwise, they'd be so distracted by life that none of this would ever get done.
I think it's
you'd
true.
Never make a grand complication if you didn't live in the high up mountains of Switzerland.
I was talking to Cameron Weiss about this a while ago, you know, years ago at this point. But you know, those grand complicated watches, you know, they're made and serviced by one person. You know, they're so rare that if the company sells you one, and we're talking about watches that are like millions of dollars, but if you get one, it was made by Sven, and it's going to be serviced by Sven. And when Sven retires, he has to like teach somebody how to service that watch for you because he's literally the only guy on the planet who could do it. It's like so crazy.
So today's best watchmakers are people, men and women, that have had to reverse engineer grand complications of old because no one's around to fix them. And so they became great watchmakers because they were, quote unquote, restorers. But what they're really doing is take someone's work that has long since died. There's no instruction manual or schematics. They just have to stare at it and figure out how to fix it. And that's basically how today's most genius watchmakers are born, mm-hmm. by that type of practice.
Yeah. I just, what's your favorite like watch factory that you visited? I bet you've been to a bunch.
Yes, I have been to many. The very first one I went to is still one of the most impressive ones, and it was in Germany, in Glashütte, and it was Allangenzone. And what I really like about their facility isn't just that it's like very neatly organized, like this room is for this function, this room is for this function. Like the doors would have these little labels on exactly what would go on in that room. But it was almost set up like a science laboratory. Or super clean. Of course, they've got these sort of white lab coats on. But you could, like, eat off the floors. Mm-hmm. You know, you've been to those fancy car manufacturers, you know, mm-hmm. like McLaren's, like, oh, it's so clean in here. Well, it was like that. And I didn't know it was so clean until, like, I went to some in Italy, right?
You could apply this to cars. Yeah.
Yeah, see, and they just treat it like they mean every movement there gets, like, disassembled and then reassembled. And it really sort of made you feel that this team of highly trained human beings, like, dripped their time and effort and love and training into these objects.
Yeah.
And it was so hard not to be romanced by that process. It's like you leave there and you're like, yeah, $50,000, that's a good entry-level price.
You know? It does happen. I went to Ulysse Nardin. I'm not a super Ulysse Nardin fan of their watches. Their designs are very aggressive and they're not for everybody, and some of them are not for me. Although the Freak is on my short list of dream watches.
Cool.
The Freak rules. And that cool new alien clock thing they
have. UFO that has nothing to do with flying objects.
Yeah, the egg. It's a weird egg.
It's like
a boy. Oh, buoy. Yeah. It is. It should be, yeah. They should just call it a fucking buoy.
It looks like a buoy.
It does, yeah. But same kind of thing. You know, white lab coats, absolutely dust free. Had to put the booties on my shoes to enter the building, you know, and put on a dust coat the whole deal.
In Japan, they force you to take your shoes off.
Do they? Mm-hmm. That's Japan.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think you could have taken your shoes off if you didn't want to go with the booties. But they had this really intricate conveyor belt system where that would go from watchmaker station to station, where it would like lift it up, you know, almost like one of those golf tees at the driving range, up in the middle of your thing, and you'd work on it, and then you'd hit the button, and it would go back down, and the next one would come up.
It's it's a sort of automated, facilitated assembly line,
right?
And some places have those, some don't. That helps with the volume. I mean, you know, traveling all these factories has allowed me to realize that part of the game is how do you make the nicest watch possible as quickly as possible? Because so many of these companies, their profits are literally limited by how many watches they can produce.
Mm-hmm.
So the question is, how do you scale these operations? Because we're talking about that grand complication of that one master spending several months. That's why that guy needs to charge him like, you know, $500,000, $1 million for it, because that's all, you know, he or she is selling. But when you have a volume approach and you sell like a $6,000 to $15,000 watch, you got to make enough of them per year.
Yeah.
And the science behind that is fascinating. It's a whole other thing. It's got nothing to do with luxury, but it's like, you know, Rolex, for example, that was probably the most impressive facility I've ever been to. And it was weird because like no pictures. Like this whole song and dance about going there, I couldn't have any actual record that I've been there. Other than the photograph Rolex gave me, it's just like a memory.
Like,
I
take my picture of my name on the sign-in book, like to prove I was here?
Basically like that. And for them, you know, they've had to industrialize the process of making a perfectly finished metal object. And unless you're sort of like a micro engineer and like, I don't know, like an assembly line expert, you don't realize how difficult that is.
Well, they make their own metal.
They do forge a lot of their own metal, but people don't realize how many actual human beings they employ to do this. A lot of this is not automated. They do use automation, like you said, to move these movements around. They have this like crazy robotic system in there where they move parts around and all that stuff. But human beings, even at Rolex, are still doing so much of the work. And again, that's what's so romantic about these things. It's like, it's kind of weird, but it's like you like to wear human effort on your body.
Yeah, I think that's definitely true. I mean, whether it's jewelry or clothes or whatever, I mean, or a car, you know, saying that something is handmade is definitely a mark of
But I have to ask the weird question of why. I'm always curious why. Like, why is it about having handmade that excites us? Is it the aesthetic? Because most people don't know. Like, if your shirt was like hand knit, only you would know.
Right.
So what is it about that that gives you personal joy? Because so much of what we wear is communicating to others.
I think there's a combination of you assume that there are fewer of them because it's going to be limited by how many they can put together by
hand. So you feel
like
a big shot?
It also, I think in a really funny way, gives us a license to let the imperfections go.
Well, we love that stuff too.
You know, if it's handmade, you know, in watches, they don't let that shit go, but in cars, they definitely do.
What do they say exactly?
In cars?
Like, what can go wrong that's like the handmade is the excuse?
Oh, dude, listen, I have an Aston Martin, so I've heard Aston Martin makes beautiful but highly imperfect vehicles. And a lot of that imperfection can be, they're handmade, you know, whatever. So whereas maybe the stitching isn't quite as good as, you know, you can order a Porsche with any stitching, crazy color you want, and you can do that with an Aston Martin too, but it won't be quite as precise in one and, you know, stuff like that.
Oh, so speaking of handmade, let me give you this gift I got you.
Oh, sure, yeah. I was worried that getting the box off the table, we'd forget about it.
No, I remembered it because we were talking about this. So this is, I guess, artwork.
It looks like artwork. Looks like it's in a frame. That a frame defines, right?
Something in a frame. You have to get like a more real frame here. So okay, so let me explain some like background here. This is a print I got you. I wrote you a little note on the back, but this is from an artist that my dad was into. My dad's no longer here, and this is a print of a painting this guy did of Car Night at Bob's Big Boy, which is how I got into cars originally.
Still going on, that show.
It is still going on. So this has been going on for years, and he did like, here, I'll show you. This is supposed to be one from...
Oh, I think I've seen, it's a pretty famous, kind of a famous painting, right?
Well, this guy, Stan Klein, did a lot of stuff. I actually own some of his artwork that my dad bought, and my dad actually met him a bunch of times and talked to him. So there's sort of a lot of meaning in there.
I feel like I have seen this person's art before. Thank you so much.
You probably
awesome.
Have. Yeah, yeah, he's done a lot of stuff, but I think he was a local, and he did a lot of car stuff.
Yeah.
And he did a lot of like Southern California icons and things
very
that.
Very nice. It's very beautiful.
Yeah, so that was sort of like a, you know, congrats on this amazing space.
Thank you.
This is not the first time I've been here, but you know, if you haven't been to the West Side Collector's Garage, you got to come.
We have wall space for this, right?
You do.
Right there.
So much amazing
beautiful
wall space here. So I just thought you would
thanks
enjoy
very
that
much. And
yeah,
you were right. I do. I appreciate that.
You're welcome.
I glanced at the letter. We don't need to read it into the air, but I appreciate the letter too.
Oh, yeah.
The note is good. My wife will really appreciate the note. My wife really appreciates the note.
Tell her I wrote it for her.
Which I will. Just cross out.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thanks, man.
So,
that's awesome.
So
you know what's fucking really disappointing?
What?
I've never actually been to the Bob's Big Boy meet. I know it's still going on, but I've never been. Jay, have you been?
I've been.
Is it good?
It's tonight. Let's go. Right
it's
after
tonight?
This. Right after this.
Oh, my God.
It's 6 o'clock.
It's 6 o'clock. For
like 5 or 7, something like
is
that.
Is it every Friday?
Every Friday.
Really? Have you been before?
I think they were even doing it over COVID.
I haven't been in like 20 years, to be honest. I'm happy to go back.
I can't go tonight, but we should go.
I think it would be fun to go.
Yeah.
I remember going as a kid, and a lot of the cars were for sale. And
that
I remember
seems
thinking,
to be the thing.
I remember thinking how affordable they were at the time. So I remember there'd be cars then that were like under 10 grand, they're like 50, 60, 70,000 today.
Yeah.
We were talking about this. We were talking about the Mercedes, the Gullwings.
Uh-huh.
That I remember seeing one. I specifically remember the price. It was in like immaculate condition for like $40,000. Okay. And I know that they're like way more today.
They're like $1 million.
I know,
yeah.
But like it was like $40,000 like 20 years ago. And there was like all these, you know, American muscle cars, again, perfect condition, but you could buy them for like $16,000, $20,000 bucks. And now I understand they're a little bit more popular.
I mean, look, you know, you can still buy a muscle car for $20,000 bucks. You know, how much you pay for something like that depends on all kinds of crazy stuff besides is the body straight, you know, and does it look pretty good? You know, if you don't care about originality and if you don't care about numbers matching, and if you don't care about some stuff that the collectors care about, then you can get a great, cool-looking, nice driving car for like a very reasonable amount of money.
At the time, I remember the sort of like the price that everyone was talking about was always like the price of Mustangs, because those would move a lot. And I remember the a friend of mine, he would get some and he would restore them and resell them. And he was spending like, he would not buy like tip-top condition ones, but he was spending like $3,000 or $4,000 or $5,000 on one. Mm-hmm. I don't even know what that can get you today.
Nothing.
But like he was getting 65, 66, 67s, maybe a few 68s, but that's what he was buying.
I don't think $3,000 will get you a shell.
Yeah, but that was like the going rate.
Yeah,
and it was
and
this was like in the 90s.
Yeah, so you know, there's a great article in this month's Hagerty magazine. I just read it this morning. Colin Comer wrote it, talking about the values of muscle cars. And, you know, because we pretty much accept that like peak muscle car was like 2007. And then it's kind of been downhill from there, but that's not actually true. It's obviously, it's going to be, not obviously, but it is cyclical. And so there was a peak at 2007. And an example that they used was a car that sold, it was like a Shelby GT500 that sold for like $175,000 in 2007.
Wow.
That would be peak, right? It then, the same car sold in 2011 for like $75,000. That was like the dregs. And then in 2014, it sold for like $95,000. And it just sold again earlier this year for $165,000. So we're now back almost to where the peak was in 2007 as far as muscle cars go, according to the Hagerty pricing guide.
Okay, so here's my theory on it. I actually believe that the higher the prices go, the worse it is because it makes it less accessible. I think the lower the prices are means more people can get into it, therefore it's more attractive to people. Sometimes when the prices of these cars go so high, it alienates such a big part of the market that I think it actually ends up turning people off.
Sure. I think that is definitely true, especially when you're talking about cars. On the other hand, I don't think that this particular market trend is bringing up those entry-level cars as well. We're talking about primo collectibles, numbers, matching, stuff that is, it's not going to be a my first muscle car for anybody. I mean, you can still get, you know, plenty of good driver quality, you know, that, and with a muscle car, like, if the numbers don't match, like, half, you know what I mean? It's like, so you can get stuff where it's like, works perfectly, like literally get in it, turn the key, drive it across the country, looks great, paint is good, interior is good, but like none of it matches the numbers on the build sheet, so that means it's just not worth anything.
I mean, look, I'm not really in it for sort of the money part. I think that if you want to have a classic car for the experience of driving it, the stuff matching doesn't really matter. It's just, does it offer that authentic experience? Can you feel what it was like to have that horrible steering? You know, all that amazing space on the inside, you could camp out in there. I mean, you know, driving a modern car versus like a mid-60s American car, it's like, it's so alien. And it's really cool to see what it was both like. I mean, today, you know, you drive in a seat that's basically like a race car engine seat, sort of like gripping you. Like
in
those,
the good cars, yeah.
Those bench seats, you'd be sliding around everywhere.
Dude.
You know, like,
I remember doing a TV show bit in like 2011, and it was like, you know, some old Charger or something, and it had a fucking straight bench, and like it wasn't a Charger, but it was some old Mopar thing, and like I turned that bitch into a corner and just ring, just right across.
They were meant to go in a straight line only.
Yeah, I mean it was really, and then you get to Detroit for the first time and you go, I understand.
Yeah,
I understand this. Yeah. They just kept it in the DTW. They just didn't go anywhere. When they did, they didn't drive.
Okay, here's,
you know?
Here's a really stupid question. I hope it's not a stupid question. But are there really cool American cars to drive right now? Because it's been a while since I've sort of...
new cars?
What are the decent American cars now?
Oh, for sure. Well, first off, the new Corvette is one of the best driving sports cars at right now at any price.
I mean, I should hope that the Corvette
is good at
something.
The new Corvette's a super modern car.
Okay.
It's a super modern car. Dual clutch gearbox, mid-engine,
but you have to get
ride.
Like a highly spec'd version.
Not highly spec'd. No, you can't get the you know, the Corvette.
I had that problem. I told you about that.
Right. You know, Corvettes. There's a certain thing where the engineers build the best Corvette they can build. That's called the Z51. Right. That's an optional package. Then the accountants go, okay, you guys have done your job. Go go up to the North Shore, the North Fork, wherever the fuck you go, the UP in Michigan. Go have a little vacation. All right, guys, they're gone. We need to get this thing down to 59.9. What are we cutting? What are we cutting, boys? We're cutting the brakes? Cutting the suspension?
So heartbreaking.
Let's cheapen this bitch out, huh? We ever see that? Do you ever see that video of Let's Basic This Bitch? Do you guys see that? The Amazon Basics video? Some company that makes backpacks basically did a parody video called Let's Basic This Bitch.
Oh, I gotta see
where
this.
Where the people at Amazon see this beautiful backpack these guys are selling and then reverse engineer it for Amazon Basics. They take off all the good features, but it looks just like it, but it doesn't have any of the actual engineering they did to make it good. And so that's how you get the 59.995 Corvette that you can rent from Hertz.
Because a buddy of mine rented this Corvette. He didn't know this, and so we tried to have a fun drive, and like after about 15 minutes, we overheated the transmission. Mm-hmm. I'm like, what did we do wrong here?
Do-do-do-do, the more you know.
Yeah, so I mean, I got upset when you told me that they even sold such a model. So that's why I had to ask about American cars, because you would know. Okay, other than the Corvette.
So look, the Corvette is great. I mean, the new Mustangs are good. They are, especially at the higher end, they're a lot of fun. What else is looking? I mean, those are the sports cars, right? I mean, look, Tesla is doing good things. You know, Tesla, the new Model S, even though I think the steering wheel's dumb and there's a lot wrong with the company, that is the fastest accelerating production car right now. So good for them.
Okay, so
there's that.
You say that, and so then I have a conversation with Audi, and they say things like, yeah, I know that Tesla like popularized electric cars, but ours are actually engineered really, really well. And knowing what I know
about
Audi,
that's an accurate statement.
It's hard for me not to go with Audi's logic and be like, yes, I think Audi's going to be the one for me. Because, you know, as car people, I mean, I drive an Audi now, but like I totally get that. And I'm just thinking in my mind, like there's so many brands that you just completely skipped over, like American brands. You're like, I can see you like naming the brand, going through the list of things, like, nope, nothing to comment on there. Next brand, nothing to comment there. And I want there to be something.
Oh no, well look,
all...
I have a Ford Mach-E.
Okay.
Which is basically, you know, a Tesla that's screwed together properly. That's what that car is. It's a Model Y where the things are on.
Why is screwing it together such a hard thing?
Because it is. Because
really?
It just is. Because despite what a lot of people will tell you, it's hard. They don't like. They don't want to see it as being hard. They think that anything that was done by a big OEM is inherently bad because it was done by a big OEM. But there, and I'm not that big OEMs are like entirely sympathetic characters in all sense of the word. They're companies. They do shitty things that companies do. But like, for the most part, they figured out how to screw a car together properly. They spent like 100 years doing it.
I mean, didn't Ralph Nader, didn't he really sort of explain to the industry you have to worry about these things? It just seems like after several generations.
Bro, move fast and break things, bro. It's a disruption. It's a disruption. It's more important to
it's
be the future.
It's hard for me
future.
To stand behind that.
Good. Means you have a fucking head screwed on straight.
I mean, I went to law school. There's like laws about that.
Yeah, there should be. There really should be. Yeah. It's too bad.
How did that permeate culture? I mean, like, think about that in the watch industry, the car industry. I mean, like, people, okay, in the car industry, people's lives are at stake. In the watch industry, just the reputation's at stake.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, it's funny because some of these brands, especially those exotic complications, especially around the 2000s to sort of 2012 period, they would routinely release watches into the market that were like that. They moved too fast, and every one of those watches broke. And I don't want to mention names, but I remember I was at Neiman Marcus, and Neiman Marcus at the time sold really high end watches. And
oh, really? Did they?
Oh yeah, really high end, like $80,000, $100,000.
Oh wow! I didn't know.
So I was talking to the salesperson, and she was talking about one specific brand, and she had said that every single one of the watches from that brand that she had sold
came back. Not
only been returned, but most instances, the people wanted another one or wanted to be fixed after repeatedly bringing the same watch back that would break. It was this weird thing where they liked the design, and they just couldn't fathom the idea that it was just a pure lemon, that the company would release something that fundamentally did not work.
Yeah.
And now there's a little bit less of that, but that was like a common thing that happened. And I think the problem is they're just like, oh, those are rich people problems. You know, we'll just give them a free watch here or there. And that's what happens a lot. I mean, there was a watch, I remember that I was at a factory, and it was finally being produced 7 years late. 7 years late. And I just imagine most consumers' feelings when the thing that you order, your expensive luxury item, comes 7 years late.
Yeah.
It's just, that was a common thing in the watch industry.
It happens in cars too, right? You know, you don't typically, you wouldn't have ordered it first. You know, it doesn't come 7 years after you order it. There's cars like the Acura NSX that took 10 years to develop. They went through multiple, like, complete iterations of different cars.
Yeah, but they would have had your full money for 10 years.
Yeah. No, they would have. Yeah. I'm just saying there's a parallel. I'm not saying that, like, right, you know. With Tesla, I think it's a little different because they actually sold something that was knowingly fake.
Their Kickstarter campaign.
Yeah, I mean, their car did include a $10,000 Kickstarter campaign, and there's people who paid for that feature, the, quote, full self-driving feature, and at this point, they started selling that feature 5 years ago. People have, you know, returned their leases, sold their cars, having gotten absolutely nothing for their money. And what's very strange about it is there should be class action suits saying we all were defrauded. But instead, there's a double down digging in of, you know, we contributed somehow. You either it's a sunken cost thing where you don't want to admit you were conned, or you just don't want to believe it wasn't real, or, you know, something. You're embarrassed.
People want to be romanced with fantasy these days, and I think it's a big problem. You know, it's a problem. It's a regulation thing. I mean, Elon Musk, for all of his virtues, has no problems lying because he knows there's very little punishment for lying.
Yeah.
You know, our politicians approve that. I don't know the fix to that situation, but, you know, it'd be really great to build in a couple of more, you know, remedies for blatant lying in important positions, especially politics, whatever. I mean, what do we do? We just all have to become better critical thinkers. It's it's a personal responsibility. No one can protect us but ourselves. And the sad thing is we live in the information age, yet people have a worse time now knowing the difference between fact and fiction than ever before.
True.
I don't understand this paradox. I have to wrap my mind around it.
I think it's just like when you have all the access to everything in the world, you know, and I think it's there's an overwhelming amount of information that is sent to you algorithmically.
We need more human gatekeepers. Human gatekeepers.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, look, Facebook and Google are very rich. Why don't they just put the algorithm on hold and say, we'll just use some of our massive cash reserves to have humans feeding other humans content?
But listen, somebody has to pay for the yachts that go into the other yachts.
The yacht. Yeah, I know those. But mechanically, right. That's very cool to see.
I know.
That.
Like,
it's like a Transformer
right,
birth.
You know,
because okay? So cool.
The Microsoft people, they have yachts that go into other yachts. And here's the Google people are thinking, yachts that go into planes.
Or the car. I like when there's a car or the vehicle that goes in the yacht, or it's like a little ATV or something like that.
I saw a Mini Cooper on the deck of a yacht once.
There you go.
And there was a crane. Just
come on.
Yeah.
You see the helicopter a lot, but
the helicopter's a helicopter is just next level
shit. The desire to build a cooler yacht is a great reason to exploit a lot of people. I totally agree. You know? I mean, Larry Ellison's into that type of thing.
Do you think it's like, but you guys don't understand. This yacht has a
mainstream
society. That's literally out of a movie.
Understand that yachts are the ultimate show off because what they end up being are like portable skyscrapers.
Yeah.
That's really where they are. So if you are among the most elites, the most rich, your house is great and all, but it can't move around.
Right.
But your mega yacht, it's like a trophy that you can just sort of tout along. It's the ultimate trophy wife.
It's brought to where you're going.
Yeah, and everyone knows how insanely expensive it is. They just know that you just have to keep pouring money into it.
Yeah.
It is the ultimate status symbol, and it there's nothing above that. Yacht people love watches, but you can't have a party, you know, in your watch. You know what I mean?
I always talk about a watch. I frame a watch as being like a sports car you can bring into the bar with you. I interviewed that dude, Simon Wolf, on my watch podcast.
Yeah,
he makes those watch winders, the Wolf watch
from
winders.
Wolf, down the street.
Very nice man. I enjoyed his company very much. And I was like, listen, tell me, like, what's the craziest, you know, because they do the custom joints too. There's off the rack, you know, standard.
Oh, yeah.
There's the safes, which are crazy. And then it's like, you know.
Did he tell you?
He said the craziest setups are on yachts.
Yeah.
He said he did a like a 300 watch winder wall on somebody's yacht, which is absolutely insane.
I mean, there's a point where you have to think to yourself, how do you display all of your watches? And
yeah.
This is a
in so, yeah, somewhere a niche that it is not taxable. How do I display it?
Like, no. But literally, let's say you have a room or an office or something like that. There's no default way. Like art, you put it in a frame, you put it on the wall. Everyone agrees how to display art. No one agrees really about how to display watches. It's sort of a cottage industry, and you have like Boobin and Zorweg, for example, which is really elaborate safe and display maker, and they're commissioned to do entire rooms and stuff like that. But like the weird yacht guy equivalent in the watch industry are those people that build those lavish display rooms. Mm-hmm. Sometimes no one but themselves go into it. So think about all the secret, like...
It's just got, like, one chair in the middle that just slowly swivels around.
And they sit in there, they lock the door, they sit in there alone with their watches, and they admire them for hours.
You know what that is? That's like those stereos that you can only listen to from one seat.
Oh, a listening room. Listening room.
Yeah, where you have, like, a $300,000 stereo, but
it's
you need
like
to sit...
It's like that ad from the 90s where the
Maxell guy. Yeah, exactly like that, yeah. There's like audio nerds that have that, yeah.
So there's the watch version of that.
I kind of sympathize though. Like I keep, you know, I don't want to say where I keep mine, but like they're not visible. Let's just say that the only one I can see is the one on my wrist.
I think that more people do need to be concerned about security. I've had a lot of very high level people that are watch collectors admit to me about theft from their home and stuff like that. So it is a serious thing. I recommend to anyone who has a big watch collection to invest in a safe.
Yeah.
You know, you have here in Southern California, Brown Safe Manufacturing. They make amazing safes, and they have watch safes as well. And so
the watch safes start to get really crazy.
But that's the thing. You don't need a watch safe.
No, you just need a safe. No. The watch safes have the winders built in, which is not necessary unless you have super complicated watches.
It's a vanity thing. You don't really need the winders. It's a vanity thing. But it's sort of this. A lot of watch people are included in this class of people of like, what do you get the so-and-so that has everything? And a personalized safe for your watches is, you know, that's one of those gifts. And you can buy more of them as you get more watches.
Yeah.
That's a great thing.
Do you, when people ask you watch advice, how many of those questions are centered around the watch as an investment and the values and stuff like that versus finding a watch that actually fits a lifestyle and a set of activities?
I think actually the questions tend to be somewhere in the middle, where somebody is really concerned about spending the money on a purchase they won't like. And so they try to buy a conservative option. And it goes back to what you were saying earlier, where they weren't buying to their taste. They were buying to what someone else told them to get, which I know is fundamentally going to lead them into a direction where they're not going to enjoy the watch. Watches, like cars, like clothing that you choose for yourself, you tend to be the happiest with, right? So I try to push people in a direction where they have to make a decision for themselves. I refuse to tell them what to. Sometimes people are like, literally, the most common email I get, do I buy A or do I buy B?
Yeah.
I'm like, dude, I don't know you.
Yeah.
Like, you could be happy with either or neither. I don't know.
Yeah, and you go, do D, E, G, and J not exist? Why don't they exist? Yeah.
People who like watches tend to be confident. And if you don't have the confidence to make a decision for yourself, then just hold off on buying a watch. You're not ready yet. So that's really my advice. You have to be a confident person to buy the watch, to spend the money on it, to own it, to wear it. I mean, some of the watches that I wear, some of the watches you wear, they make a very bold, expressive statement. They are not for the shy.
Yeah.
There are watches you can wear if you want to hide behind them. It's when I say, do you wear the watch or does the watch wear you?
Yeah.
You can hide behind it. You can wear a fancy Rolex and just hide behind it. And that's why they're so popular.
That's interesting. The concept of hiding behind a fancy Rolex, just by displaying it, you go, I fit into this club.
It gets all the attention.
Yeah. Put me in this box where you know people like me go because I'm wearing this watch.
In the car world, the same thing happens.
Yeah. I was going to say, isn't that like a Ferrari thing too? Like,
exactly.
Is that sort of a...
It would be the GT. I mean, you could... A lot of watches...
Any buy-in club, right?
They always like... Every watch has a parallel in a car, and you know, various. We can go through that bit again if we like, but I mean, the really popular ones, the ones you can recognize from across a room, especially if they have an accepted value that is also high. You know, It's a thing to have.
Look, you and I are into individuality. We want people to know us for who we are, not for what we represent, not for being as part of some class or some, you know, archetype. We are individuals, and I think we love the fact that watches have the variety that allow us to express very nuanced statements about ourselves. So I say don't waste that. Don't wear a generic statement. Wear a nuanced statement. And I think watch collecting appreciation is walking down that road where you have the experience and skills to make even more nuanced statements with what you wear. And for me, that's sort of like an apex of collecting, is being able to choose that watch that manifests the exact emotion I want to express that day.
Yeah. I mean, I try to do that with what I pull out of the box that day. And it's the only thing I really have, because everything, I wear the same clothes every other day. So it's not like, it's like I'm wearing a t-shirt and shorts or jeans. And people watching this show, like, I have the fucking same 10 t-shirts and the same, like,
because they're comfortable and they work.
Yeah, I'm not original, but like, you can tell how I'm feeling by what watch I'm wearing or what activity I'm going to do, by that
you
watch.
You don't have to make sure they're washed.
Right.
You just have to make sure they're wound a little bit. Even then, you can do it on the spot.
Sometimes you don't even set the date. Fuck it,
Oh my God, that's why I like no date watches, because it's just like the date annoys me. Like,
I understand.
The ones I've done, every watch I've designed has no date.
Yeah.
Because, don't get me wrong, I like the complication, but like, I'd rather have no date than stare at my watch and be the wrong date and then sit there and try to fiddle with it. That's why I don't wear perpetual calendars. So for people who don't know, these are watches that take into consideration leap years.
Yeah.
So if your watch runs down, it unwinds every single time. You got to sit there with like a little stylus and push little buttons on the side. 10 minutes later, you got to go online. What day of the moon phase is it? Find some little like calculator. And
I had a perpetual for a year. I never let it die.
That's why you were so afraid.
Yeah, I didn't know how to reset it. I kept it going the whole time, and it was cool. I mean, it was awesome. It was IWC, and it was like, if you kept it running, it would be good for 300 years. Like, it would keep going for 300 years.
Of course,
you
never have to service the
watch.
Never,
ever, no. What happens in
300 years? Does it disintegrate?
You have to, they have to put a new date disc in it.
I know. Because they have the year. They have the year on this.
Four-digit year.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
I just think it's fine. I'm like, they always have those stories. I'm like, yeah, so what are they planning for 400 years from now? Like, is the manufacturer going to still be there? Do they have, like, a plan? Because you have to build this stuff in. These companies that last for hundreds of years. You have to have, like, a whole rule book.
They've been around for, what, 150?
I mean, some of these brands
I think IWC is 150.
But some of these have been close to 300, like Vacheron, like 275 years.
Yeah.
Wow. Like, continuous operation.
Yeah.
Nobody thought about this?
That's crazy. I mean, some of these companies are really, really, the archives go deep.
Is it the type of thing that you just take it apart and then, not like that's easy, but you send it to someone, to them perhaps, and then they just put a new disc in there? I know you said that like it's simple.
Oh, for the date thing? It is. It's literally that simple. They take it out and they would
Okay, but these parts are extremely small.
Yeah.
Things tend to be lost. I'm just thinking like
not
someone-
Not simple for me,
I didn't mean
but
to make
simple
it sound
for
easy.
Them.
Yeah.
It's simple.
But it's possible. You were serious about that.
Like how much tiny objects from 300 years ago do we still have around now? I think it's a limited amount.
Probably.
Like big things like furniture and art, okay, that'll stay. But like little screws and stuff,
gone.
Don't we have a bunch of watches from then? The really high-end stuff that people would have kept?
So you're going to take those ones apart?
Oh, no. No, you'd make the shit. They'd make the parts.
Oh, everything's 3D printed now. Yeah,
they would remake the parts.
There's a skill set for that. So a restorer knows how to make these parts from scratch.
Right.
And that's why they're so afraid of things like silicon, because you can like mill and machine a new screw.
That's a good point.
But with silicon, you have to have all this crazy equipment that's millions of dollars, and then even then, you're not sure if you can do it.
That's a good point. Yeah, so, all these advanced composites and stuff like that. Yeah, are we going to be able to service these watches?
Oh, yeah,
shit.
So it's an interesting thing. But I mean, look, this is... You know, at the end of the day...
ETA, baby.
Yeah. This is part of the fun of watches, because we have absolutely no practical need for something that tells time 300 years from now.
Yeah.
But it's sort of like cars. It's like, well, if you're being chased by people and, you know, like there's these scenarios that you'll never have to experience, which is so fun about. I mean, the dive watches, they go 500 meters underwater. None of us can survive.
I know.
That to me
is funny. The depth competitions of like, yeah. Oh, well, you're wearing a watch that goes to 300 meters and my watch goes to 600 meters. It's like, human is dead. Like,
yeah.
100 meters.
Way, yeah. like, beyond that,
yeah.
No need at all. And the funny thing is that Rolex has all these watches with progressively more water resistance, mm-hmm. but none of them add any practical functionality. The most basic
the
one, the Submariner,
thicker
gets thicker and thicker, and you can go down to the bottom of the Mariana Trench. Okay, but if you're not
but
James Cameron, what are you doing down there?
What if you want to strap a watch to the outside of your submarine so that a fish could tell what time it was?
Then I think that you'll just, you know, you're gonna have to put it in another little chamber.
If you wanted to dive to the bottom of the Mariana Trench, you would start by putting a Rolex Deep Sea on each wrist, and you wouldn't need a weight belt. You
but
would
I like that for Rolex, this is a legitimate engineering problem. There's no
solving.
Other. There's no other issues out there that the world requires, like, you know, their attention on. Yeah. But they want to know how to put a wristwatch that's meant to go on a human being in places that no human being can go. And so I fully support them spending millions of dollars a year on the research and development that goes into all, and more. Rolex has more. They continue to get patents on things that they never release. They do so in a way, actually, it's quite interesting, to prevent other companies from doing
that
it.
That makes sense, yeah.
You know, it's kind of like, and again,
patent trolling.
I hope they don't hate me for saying this, but like the Peterson Museum here in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
It was becoming a really popular venue for watch events. So Rolex just sponsored the entire venue and said, you can't do any other watch events here.
Oh, that's hilarious.
So there's a lot of, it's very competitive, and this type of thing happens a lot. But like people are like, oh, these friendly Swiss companies. No, they're
I don't
very
think they're friendly.
They're very aggressive in these ways.
Oh, yeah. I'm very familiar with that. That's funny, though. I didn't know that about Peterson. That's very interesting. We got a bunch of questions from people.
Okay.
Do we? Is that true? Or do we only, does it only look like we do? We got
no,
a
there
few.
Are a handful.
Yeah, we got a few. Okay, let's go to the... Mark wants to know, and I've seen this before, can we identify Billy May's orange watch from the OxyClean commercial? Do you remember this watch? I'm pretty sure it's just an orange dial Seiko of some kind.
He would yell a lot, and then he died of like a cocaine overdose?
Something to that effect.
Okay. He was amusing. Do I know about it? If I saw a picture of it, I could probably...
I've looked around. There's no like really up-close pictures. It looks like some kind of like a Seiko, you know, generic dive watch, but has an orange dial.
I mean, he was probably looking for an orange watch because it went with the theme.
Yeah.
And I think like any orange watch would do for him. So I don't know if it like... It's really that special.
You're probably right. I don't think the watch was that special, but it's hard to find.
I just think he needed he lent that little like orange accent to the blue.
Yeah.
Well, there's
yeah.
so much content about this guy.
There's a lot of Billy Mays content.
It's not this by any chance.
No.
No.
Okay, no
that came out way afterwards.
Yeah. I don't know. I've tried looking, following that rabbit hole before, and I'm pretty sure it's just an orange
dial. I see
style.
The bracelet, but I don't. If I saw the bracelet, I could probably tell
what
you
about
made
that
it.
One, right? The square one in the middle there. Down, left. That one, there's a bracelet there on that watch. That's the watch, yeah.
That's a bit blurry there.
It looks, I know, there's no good fucking pictures, I'm telling you. There's like, no one gave a shit about this when he was alive, so there's no pictures
if
of
someone
it now.
Can, if someone can give a pretty clear picture, I can do. But so look, he's wearing multiple watches, and that one, he's got a rubber strap, whether he's a bracelet.
He wore a couple different watches. The one they want to know is the one with the orange dial. Right there, the one with the rubber, the one... that one there has a picture of the orange dial. Yeah,
yeah,
click on that.
But that's
one.
A rubber strap. That could easily be a Seiko or something.
That's what
like
I'm
that.
Saying. Yeah, that looks like a Seiko.
Look,
I think it is.
I love when people want to know the watch worn by a famous person or a character. I love that part of culture. I used to do that. I used to have old articles on a blog to watch where I'd pause a screen with my DVR. And I spend. I remember the show Lost. There was some watch. It ended up being a Porsche design one. But I was just so into like, what watch is he wearing in the show Lost? And then I remember I was at an event with a reporter, and this reporter was wearing the exact watch from Lost. And I grabbed his wrist. I'm like, do you know what this is? And this reporter thought I was like, he was like from like Reuters in Europe, like you know, wearing a suit and everything like that. I was like, what the hell is this man grabbing my wrist? No idea that I was like, you know. I spent all this time trying to figure out this watch. I've never actually seen one before, and he just happened to be wearing one.
God,
I was like, do you know
funny.
That this is the watch that's in Lost? He's freaked out completely.
That is
I think he probably still has some PTSD.
Good to know.
Okay, more questions.
I'm telling you, I think that one is a Seiko. Let's see. Zach Wilsey has had three Fossil watches. And wants a better, similarly minimalist day date to replace it for a daily watch. I mean, a minimalist day date, simple watch. Any ideas?
I mean, the Japanese make more day dates than probably anyone else. So
that's
I mean,
true.
I don't know how much a fossil costs. Is it like $100 to $200 now?
I think so, probably.
I think if you just went to look at Orient, maybe. Look at an Orient. Look at a Seiko. Look at a Citizen. Even Casios have some, even though those tend to be a little bit more complicated looking. But between one of those brands, yeah, you're definitely going to find something which is an upgrade. Probably.
What's that Timex Q reissue thing? How much are those? That's Timex, like GMTs? Are they day date?
Yeah, Timex is. I see Timex and Fossil as sort of similar, like styles, a little vintage style. I'm just assuming he wants something different because he really liked that. Just buy another Fossil. Timex is another good choice. Again, you're gonna. It just depends what you're looking for. The Timex ones, you know, those bracelets, they're pretty old school.
Yeah, they're cool.
I like some of those are neat, but I like the more modern experience. So a lot of the Seikos are, you know, and they're iterative designs, meaning they get better and better and better. Mm-hmm. They're not going for sort of a retro thing. So I think those are going to be a little bit more mainstream friendly.
Cool. Tony has a 1972 Rolex Blueberry GMT Master 1675. Sell or hold?
Okay. Watches are something you should always hold on to unless you are desperately in need of money or there's a trading situation you can get something you want more of. It's never a situation where the market says it's valuable and sell it. I want you to resist this temptation. If you're trading in equities or whatever, you can do that. But watches are not something which I encourage that behavior in. So again, if you're in desperate need of cash, go ahead. Or if there's a watch that you want even more that you can trade it for, go ahead and do that.
I think that's sound advice, actually. Yeah. The one on top, Jay?
Yeah.
Troy says, super sleeper daily. 500e Mercedes versus BMW E28 M5. Who wins? Well, the E28 M5 is going to be more agile and more fun to drive and lighter. The 500e will be more of a highway cruiser, battle tank. Here's the thing. The words super sleeper. In order for a car to be a sleeper, it must be fast. And these cars are not fast. They were fast 30 years ago, 35 years ago. Not fast now. So the sleeper no longer applies. Now what we're talking about is vintage cruising. And as vintage cruisers, they're both excellent, but the 500e will be much less interesting to own and drive than you think it will. Nobody gives a shit it was engineered by Porsche except you. It's just an old, heavy automatic transmission sedan that was made well. But
I mean, those are such weird options. Like, only, you know what I mean?
Well, they were competitors at the time. So.
I know, but it's like we're having like a historical conference. Like, imagine the world 30 years ago. So many things, variables to take into consideration.
Cars are like that.
If you're into cars and coffee, I feel like the E28 M5 wins.
For sure.
Don't you think?
For sure.
Like from the cool factor with your friends.
For sure.
And stuff
especially
like that.
If you have to drive up Angeles Crest to your cars and coffee. I'd much rather do that in a fucking M5 than I would in that Mercedes.
Big time. I mean, the Mercedes has, at least for me, a little bit more just sort of curb appeal personality.
Panache.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Like, you're right. Maybe there's not as good of a driving experience, but there's sort of like an air about you rolling up and something like that.
This is where it came down to you and the. I don't know you. I don't know what you want. I don't know what the best thing
is. Yeah, exactly.
For you.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. So I would probably agree that the Mercedes would be, not as cool to drive, but probably if you're going for the older car, part of it is the expression you're trying to make with it.
Sure. Mm. Chappie says, my dream watch growing up was a two-tone Tag Heuer Sports Elegance that now looks terrible. Any watches
those
that you have coveted and look back on and think, what the hell was I thinking? That's funny.
That is a good question.
That's a funny question.
There's something that I did similarly to that. There have been watches that in the past were made fun of for being horrible, and then I wanted to know, after a certain amount of years have elapsed, if you go back and they still look bad.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the ones that famously came to mind, I was like, I remember I was in Miami. I was just thinking to myself, I wonder if I looked back at the old Nataf era Zenith Defies. So Terry Nataf was a colorful character who was the CEO of Zenith for a while. And he made some good decisions and bad decisions, but people often accuse a lot of the designs he created direct for not being very attractive. And he made a new version of the Defy, there was the Extreme, and there was the Zero-G Tourbillon thing. And I was like, maybe these are cool. And I looked back on it, and I just remember like the look on my face when I saw them. I was like, oh no, they are horrible. but oftentimes, when we like something as a kid or something like that, we associate that design with a feeling we had at that age. So it's less about what it looks like and more about how it makes us feel.
Right.
If it still gives us that positive sense of nostalgia, chances are we still care about it a whole lot. So I think oftentimes when we're younger and we're into something, there's always still going to be some value behind it. Even if it doesn't represent us anymore, a younger version of ourselves will continue to like it. But I find it strange that someone would absolutely think something is gorgeous and then later in life absolutely hate it. At least I can't relate to that experience.
Well, things that are like heavily trendy, like I wore JNCO pants back in the day, and now I think they're
ridiculous. The really baggy ones?
Yeah, yeah.
You wore those, huh?
I did alongside all my friends.
Okay,
yeah.
We're all raving and everything?
They were raving more than me, but I wore the pants too, yeah. But I can appreciate that.
I think you still pull those off.
I fucking, bro, if you could get those pants now, they'd be like $1,000. Like,
are JNCOs really that expensive now?
I don't know. They're probably not. And someone's going to call me out and show me that they are around, and then I'm going to have to buy them.
I think we're going to get a Poshmark right now and start to find our sizes.
They used to come in, it was three, you know how pants are like.
Too big for you, way too big for you. On
no,
the floor
but like,
already.
You know how like, you know, pants are like 34, 32 or whatever?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, like waist length?
Yeah.
They would have bottoms too. So it would be 34, 32, 60. That would be the bottom. And the ratio, it was all about the ratio of waist to bottoms.
Yeah.
And the 60 would be the diameter of the bottom of each leg. So the JNCO Colossus, which is the biggest ones you could get, they looked like skirts. It would just kind of sit and your legs would move and it would look like you were a ghost floating.
So these were popular because you could shoplift more easily?
It just got ridiculous. No, they started as like skateboarding pants or whatever, and maybe eventually you could like hide shit in there.
It's like a liability if you're doing
it. It got out of hand. Like most fashion trends, it got completely out of hand.
I'm not really a trendy person. Like I remember when Apple first came out with the iPod and everyone was wearing the little white earphones and I wouldn't wear one because everyone else had
it. They're still doing that. They just got rid of the wires, so now you don't see them as much.
Time it was really a thing because I was living in San Francisco at the time.
That was like an instant douche indicator. If I saw fucking white things come, I was like,
it was everywhere,
I'm not talking
right?
to you.
So I never did that because I'm a counter trendy. I wait for things. I ask myself, do I like it? But I'll tell you this, I'm very open-minded with new watch designs. It's very often the case that
you wear some avant-garde shit.
Yes, because it's new and it's original, mm-hmm. and I'm happy to try it. There's a lot of people in this space that are deathly afraid of anything new, and this brings me to a conversation I had with Peter Brock that designed the Shelby Daytona. And I remember because he was doing something with Bob and Massier, and we were in Geneva. We spent like an hour chatting, and he was so focused on this idea that everything new people hate automatically, and they go through this like period of acceptance. Right, so he was saying that when this car came out, the Daytona, people were just panning it for being like the ugliest thing, and now it's a design icon.
Yeah.
And he said that he saw this over and over and over again, and not only his own career as a designer, but you know, from the side, where something new would come out, people would hate it because it's new, and then all of a sudden, it's an icon of beauty and aesthetics.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so I see people being antagonistic to new things, and I try not to be myself because it's so easy to wait for all of society to make an opinion, and then you jump on board. You're like, of course I like the nice thing. It's a lot harder to say, this is new, no one's really formed an opinion yet, but I think it's kind of cool.
Sure. I think with cars, it can be easier to form an opinion than with watches.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
I've said for sure if I saw a picture of a new car and then saw it in person and I thought it looked better in person, I've obviously, you know, said so. And if there's cars that I thought were dumb looking in the beginning and in hindsight don't look that dumb, the Porsche Cayenne comes to mind. When the Cayenne first came out, I was like, that's not good.
It was different. Mm-hmm. It was different.
It was different, and they did change it a bunch too to make it look better. With watches, I think it's maybe because it's smaller, maybe because it's just,
well, because cars, we know how to use them in the real world more often. We understand how to evaluate functional problems. With watches, it can become abstract unless you've worn it, you've seen the comfort, does it tell good time or not? These are all things that are very difficult to determine just by seeing pictures alone.
Dante says, This is a weird one.
Yeah,
Dante says we're remodeling our kitchen. What features add value for daily cooking in a small space? Get as much BTUs as you can on the burner. That's a no-brainer no matter what. Get as much countertop space as you can no matter what.
Space.
Get as much good light as you can in your cooking surface, as much fan vent as you can. And I have one of those, I have a, it's a Breville. It's like a toaster oven, but it's a convection oven that also toasts. And for me and my wife, if I'm not cooking for more than just the two of us, I make our dinner in that.
Yeah, those
of my
modern
big, like,
air fryers, whatever they're called. Those
the
are really cool.
Air fryer, toaster, convection oven combo.
You
one
know what
of those
I use
kills.
A lot? It's so embarrassing, but I love it. The George Foreman grill thing.
It's all right.
Those are so useful for so many purposes.
Yeah, they are.
Since I don't even have a microwave. Since we moved to our new place, we just never got a microwave.
Yeah.
I've lived like a year without a microwave.
My house came with one, like, built in. Literally the only thing I use it for is if I need to, like, melt butter with the quickness. Mm. I don't use it for anything
else.
It's
good to heat up rice.
I'm not a leftovers guy.
Oh.
I know, I'm weird. I don't fuck with leftovers. But those, I don't know. Any other advices for small spaces?
Oh, small spaces?
Cooking in a small space?
I mean, you're getting, like, a nice, like, blender, like a Vitamix or something like that. Those are super useful for a lot of different things. I mean, for me, I try to keep, like, fresh ingredients. So for me, having, like, too much preserved stuff, I don't want. So I want to be able to keep, like fruits and vegetables for a few days. So having space to put those.
Good tips. Good tips. Richard says, Audi RS5 Sportback or Taycan Cross Turismo as a do-it-all car. In order to answer this question, we must assume your charging situation is solved. Like, charging is not an issue ever. Otherwise, there's no such thing as do-it-all with an EV, right? Charging has to be fully solved.
I'm talking about the new one, okay.
Yeah, the new one. I mean, you have an RS5. Do you love your RS5?
Yeah, but I got mine specifically because it was probably the last naturally aspirated V8.
You don't have the new one. You have yours a couple years old with the V8.
Yeah, that's what I wanted.
Yeah,
and,
good.
And I love it, and I'm going to ride the oil train as long as it's available to us. But I mean, this notion of a do-anything car, you're not going to have the same car for the rest of your life. You're going to have a car for a few years. Use it for what it's good for. Like, nobody wants the all-purpose car. People want a purposeful car. Use it for that purpose. Clearly, you want to, like, go off-roading a little bit, go into nature a little bit. And I think that Matt brings up an excellent point about, you know, autonomy. If you have to charge a thing, I mean, what, you can get some weird solar charger out there?
I don't think this person wants to go off-roading. The Cross Turismo is the only way to get a Taycan as a wagon. You can't get a Taycan wagon without getting Cross Turismo. So you have the little
wagons
bit of,
are so practical.
I know. And in a Taycan, the wagon really, really improves the usefulness of the back seat.
It sounds like there's just one clear answer. The wagon.
If you want, well, yeah, right. But he's saying, like, if you want, basically, RS5 Sportback is a lovely gasoline-powered car, and the Taycan Cross Turismo is my favorite electric vehicle right now. So,
look, if you're just getting into electric, and it's interesting. Like I said, I like having combustion. I'm going to do it as long as possible because in the future we're not going to have options, not as many.
Mm-hmm.
Ride it out.
So the market will decide for us.
Oh, yeah.
The enthusiast can ride it out. Joe, thank you for your donation at the end. Did you see anything from Only Watch that is worth discussing?
Orange, huh?
Orange.
They always
it's
have
the year
weird,
of the orange.
They always have a color theme, which is like an optional thing that the brands can do. So Only Watch is cool because it is what I think watch auctions should be. A sale of an original one-of-a-kind thing. Like, I am really against the idea of buying watches at auction that you can get in the retail market or, like, on eBay. Like, that's stupid. But Only Watch is great because the whole idea is that brands need to create something totally original that's never been sold before there. And some brands get away with doing a prototype. Mm-hmm. Richard Mille is terrible at this. They literally just, like, oh, here's the
they
used
just,
one.
They just, like, sell their prototypes.
It's a literally used watch. Like, ah, it's famous person wore. There you go. So for them, it's kind of thing. Patek came out with a clock.
Yeah, I saw their desk clock.
Look, it's cool, but the thing is, people that like watches do not automatically like desk clocks, okay? this is not a thing that they share, okay? It's different
But I
stuff.
Do like clocks that look like buoys.
Yeah, that's cool, but this is a traditional
no,
thing.
No, Jay, scroll down. Do you see the one that looks like a buoy? Keep going. Ulysse Nardin made a desk clock that looks like a buoy. Keep going. You'll know when you fucking see it, bro.
I look for things that aren't just color change.
Space buoy. There. Right?
Oh, my gosh.
See? Space buoy.
But it's just a color change. So it is awesome. I look for things that are actually novel that have never been done before. The Constantine Chaikin is cool. I really like the MBNF where they make a wearable panda. Who doesn't want a wearable panda? And this is how ballsy they are at this point. Years ago, this never worked. A lot of these, they're just drawings. They don't even have a CAD ready yet.
Wow.
The auction's in November.
And
okay?
This is just a drawing of they're the watch just that's selling, not
that's,
made.
That's how professional they've got. Look at this one. It's a drawing of two dudes for the Deben Tunic. Look at that. There's not even, they're just like, we'll come up with an idea later.
Yeah. There's like literally, look, presenting two guys in a shed.
We'll have a meeting. Don't worry about it.
One of whom might be Howard Stern. the other one, like.
You know, that's where you're at with this. So, I mean, people are buying the maybe. This is like sort of too modern artsy where they're buying like an experience versus an object.
Mm-hmm.
I like it when you're buying an object. The ore work one there that looks kind of
right.
Like their older one.
That thing, yeah.
That's neat. That looks like one of their first watches, so that's kind of neat.
How does that work? Is that just the eight? It's showing an eight that moves across sort of a hemispherical thing.
So that scale that it moves across, that would represent all 60 minutes.
Uh-huh.
And then there's a satellite system which is kind of hidden, and so it's a jumping hour. So that would go to 9,
shit.
Then it would go to 10. And then
is it also a retrograde minutes?
No, it doesn't work that way. So when the 8 goes down, the other side of the 9 would come up. And you have to take that half circle and assume that that's a full 60-minute scale. For whatever reason, it's super minimalized. I don't even say that. But the middle, you'd know which direction it moves. You know the middle was 30 minutes.
Right. They're fucking cool. I mean, for those of basically the primer on this is that it is an auction in which each of these brands contribute, in theory, a totally unique watch, which, I mean, to put it in car terms, imagine there was a charity auction where every brand contributed a coach-built version of one of their cars.
It's a great theme.
Yeah. Like, imagine there was an auction where every year, every car brand contributed a running, driving show car. Like, that would be pretty crazy, and that you could buy. And so, what are you trying to do? Go up?
Yeah, but...
Go up, Jay.
But then I realize that it's always backwards.
Oh, no, sorry.
So go back up. That's from last year.
So this year the color's the orange. So everyone's got some orange shit going on.
So one of the ones I want to point out, which is, again, just another sort of funny story of the watch industry, is the F.P. Jorn one, which he calls
with the hand?
Yeah, the hand. So this is, do you know how it's the Francis Ford Coppola story?
No, I don't.
So apparently...
Jay, scroll down. There's one with a watch with a blue hand in the middle of it.
Yeah, it's an orange
strap. Right,
on there
the right,
it is, there
yeah.
It is.
Okay, okay, it's got this. It's got a blue hand.
If you
hand.
Just see this, you're like, I don't know what the hell's going on here. Now, I'm not actually sure how this works, but the idea is essentially this. There's a representation of a human hand. It looks like a blue gauntlet. And the idea is that it changes to represent each of the 12 hours.
Like, it holds up digits with its fingers?
Yes, but how does it tell 12 hours with 5 fingers? They had to figure this out. I'm not even sure how it works. And then it turns around, it rotates on itself in order to indicate the minutes.
So the hand spins, and that's minutes. The middle finger is pointing basically at the minutes.
Yeah,
right,
I guess.
On the dial.
I guess.
Well, there's a little arrow above the middle finger, so that's probably it, right?
And then the hand moves somehow. It's an automaton, and it changes shape. And I'm not really sure exactly how that works.
What if it... Do you think it does it like sign language?
Possibly.
Do you think it just holds up like the like fingers go up and down?
I mean, obviously fingers go up and down. And part of the secret is like, how did they get to work? So this idea came from Francis Ford Coppola. So F.P. Jorn was at his winery up in Napa Valley, which is lovely. And apparently they were having dinner. And Francois Paul Jorn, he's a fan of a good vintage. And Francis Ford Coppola was like, hey, can you make a watch with a hand? No, a real hand. And then he spent like 7 years figuring it out.
That's like how watches work. Like it's like someone drunkenly gives you an idea.
Yes.
And then you have a patent on an animated hand.
So when Francis Ford Coppola, I don't know what's going on in his mind these days, but apparently it's this type of thing. And a watchmaker that goes around making the whims of the extremely rich and powerful come true.
Yeah.
And then you have, so this is the prototype. Again, another prototype. He will make more of these. But he's like, oh, this is the first one that kind of works. I guess I'll sell it.
And then it'll be worth...
And that's only one.
And it'll be worth, like, so much, because it's the prototype.
But it's just sort of like the person that buys this, you know, part of the reason is the whole, you know, Francis Ford Coppola thing, you know, and wine, I guess.
I guess.
But that's the type of thing they're selling. That's this interesting, weird, crazy stuff that...
I like this a lot.
Yeah.
I think this is fun.
Yeah, it is fun. And then to make it Only Watch, they just throw an orange strap on there. That's what I like about him. He's like, this had nothing to do with Only Watch, but it was kind of ready, and if I put an orange strap, it matches the theme.
But I do like very unconventional methods of displaying the time.
What are some of your favorites?
I mean, I like I like all the weird shit that MB&F does. I mean, for sure, I just like all that strange stuff.
Okay.
I really like HYTs and with the bellows and the liquids and whatever the fuck they're doing over there. For those who've never heard of an HYT watch, it is literally a pump that you wear on your wrist that pumps a colored liquid around these tubes.
And get them while you can, because they just went bankrupt.
Did they really?
Oh, yeah.
So now's the time?
Yeah.
Dive in.
Liquidate. No, but that's a funny thing. When that happens, it's not like on the mainstream market, but I'll start to hear about the watches being liquidated and the deals.
Really?
Oh, my God. Oh, yeah.
Bro. If that really happens, we need to make some moves.
Oh, okay.
We need to dive in.
Okay.
If that happens, Publishers Clearinghouse
That has happened.
Really?
Yes.
For HYT?
Yes.
Oh, bro. Talk after the show.
Okay.
how do you service one of those if the company's not like around?
Well,
anymore?
Pressiflex still is. So the parent technology company
is.
Oh,
okay. Okay.
Yeah.
Is that where the service department is?
It gets complicated, but let's just say they've made a lot of parts.
Yeah.
But worst case scenario, you have this great story about
worst
this watch
scenario,
you can't fix.
Worst case scenario, you can buy the brand. I mean, all the parts.
Think about people that have the cars that they can't fix. Oh, yeah. Those are the best stories. Those are the sexiest things.
Dude, I had a DeLorean. I went to a place in Texas that bought the entire company and receivership.
Yeah.
That had thousands of parts, everything you can imagine. And not only that, you'd go down there and they'd have, you know, the expected things. Racks of engines, rows of steel body panels, all the shit. And then you'd go in this other aisle and there'd be these enormous bins with like chairs and desks and typewriters. And you're like, what the fuck is all this? And they bought everything. They bought the whole company. And so it included all this garbage too.
Did you see the really unsatisfying DeLorean watch? The Romain
yes.
Jerome one?
It's heinous.
They got to come out with a better one.
I don't like car watch collabs like that.
It could have been so much better, though.
I just don't like them.
Well, because that one didn't work.
Because I'm a grumpy dickhead, but I guess I just don't like the collabs.
You don't like it because they often are disappointing. If they were great, you'd love it.
That's true, I guess.
Because today...
I've never seen one that's, like, incredible.
I think that should be your thing. We'll get you we'll have you crave direct a watch that reminds you of the DeLorean. It's not going to have DeLorean parts in it.
What about when they put parts of things in the watch? Do you like when they use parts of other things in the watch?
So this became a big deal, actually, speaking of Romain Jerome, when former CEO Yvan Arpa decided to put bits of the Titanic in a watch. I own one of these watches.
You do? You
cool.
own
yeah.
you own a White Star GMT?
I have one
you
of the...
stop running at exactly 4:12 a.m.
No,
every
no,
day?
No, no, no. But this was controversial because there was this mission that went down there, salvaged some metal. The company bought some of this metal and just like there was a tiny little bit of it like mm-hmm. in the alloy, okay? But it made such a big deal.
Oh, it was in the alloy? It wasn't even like a disc on the back? It was like
no, it was like melted
into
it. Yeah, yeah.
What
it was
a waste.
Like,
you
that's
just
why
tell
they
people.
Called it Titanic DNA. It was like trace amounts.
Oh, my God. That's hilarious.
They were being literal. Okay?
That's hilarious.
So it was so little amount. But there was these people like, you're celebrating death. It's so morbid. Those people suffer. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it's like.
You're like, and I'd wear their bones if I could.
And people do that. People wear like their enemies' teeth and stuff. I mean, come on. It's not that big of a deal. It's not like I have a shrunken head around my neck or something. So, I mean, I think it's weird. I have watches with things in there.
My watch that I'm wearing right now has things in it.
I know. It's
my
like,
watch has spruce goose parts in it.
It's a weird thing where it's like I own a piece of history, yeah. You know, like I'm carried around. I mean, psychologically it feels weird, but from the side, it probably is a strange manifestation of human character.
Right.
It's a weird thing that we like that. Because it's just symbolism. It's just pure symbolism. You know what I mean? Mm. It's like people with like the religious artifacts. Like, it doesn't do anything. It's just it symbolizes some special. You have special power.
Yeah.
For throughout all of human history, we think we've.
I can actually fly because I have a piece of the
special powers
tree,
you know? Because we carry bird feathers or something like that. It's I don't know why we think that way. It's I mean we make a plane, we can fly, but just the feathers themselves is it suggestive of our ability to fly? I'm
curious.
It just
reminds
about that.
Us that we can fly.
I like those questions, by the way.
Yeah, sometimes they got.
Did we
some
choose
good
like
ones.
4 out of 1,000, or how's that work?
And that was all.
Okay.
That was it. It was edited good. As long as you ignored the right side of the page, which was full of a bunch of nonsense.
That's the thing that I've learned is ignore the comments. If you're someone like us who produces content that invites commentary, we should always know what people are talking about. But I think that reading a lot of the comments, like that's their private conversation. We really shouldn't be overhearing
it. It's a very good point. It is. It's there. It's on that side of the wall.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The audience should be able to have a conversation
true.
That doesn't include us.
No, every time I wade into the comments, I regret it.
Every single time.
In that book about stupid people, like every interaction that you have with a stupid person will produce a negative result. Like that's literally.
Did you say book about stupid people?
Yeah, I'll show it to you.
Okay.
It's great.
Wow.
It's good. It's really, it'll change your life.
Okay.
Seriously. You'll understand what you're dealing
with. I'm excited to learn about stupid.
It's a great read.
Okay.
Thanks for coming down, dude.
Thank you.
That's the show. That's the thing.
I really enjoyed it.
Yeah.
This was great.
Yeah, no. I like that, you know, this was ostensibly about watches, but only kind of. That's how I like to do show.
That's my
only
life.
Kind of about the thing that it's like supposed to be about.
Well, there's still a lot more topics to discuss.
There are, outside of watches.
Yeah, and I had fun. And again, this just sort of illuminates the type of private conversations that watch people have. And mm-hmm. I think that's interesting.
I do too.
Because what's interesting is some of these events have these like wannabe posers that are not really watch lovers, but want to like appear as though they're a watch lover. They're like a watch lover in disguise because they want to be accepted by the watch lover group. I'm sure the car people have that as well.
Well, I mean, look, yes, that's true. When I've gone to watch events, even like when I was first starting to go to them, like I didn't really know like what I was doing, but like I did appreciate the conversations I would listen in on and stuff like that. So like I like talking to you about it because you have a lot more like, you know, for the same reason that I like going to a press launch with the engineers there who built the car. So I go, hey, man, the brakes feel fucking kind of weird on this. Why is this like this? And they go, well, we dialed it this. And so I get when I hang out with you, I get the why, not just the what, which is good.
Thank you.
Yeah, that's good.
Good morning.
Ariel is at a blog to watch. And your podcast Superlative is my shit coming out? Is my video coming out eventually?
The video, yeah, that's gonna come out.
I forget what banner it's under.
So I don't know. We might do that under Spending Time. I'm not sure, but okay. we have our Superlative podcast that's been published.
Yeah, that one's already out. And then there's a video I did with you guys about I picked 5 watches from my collection, and you brought 5.
Yeah, that'll
yours.
Be a good video. I'm sure it'll be when I don't know when this show is going up, but that video is supposed to come
next
soon.
Week.
Next week?
Next week.
Okay, yeah. We'll come soon.
All right.
Look forward to it, everyone.
Yeah, that's good. Until then, it's a blog to watch on Instagram, and Ariel's personal Instagram is Ariel to watch.
Ariel to watch.
Ariel, not Ariel. Ariel. Sorry, did I mispronounce?
I mean, I hear it so many ways all the time. I don't even know what my own name is anymore.
I hear Farah a lot. You know, I don't even correct people. Sorry.
I like to. I just say use the letters R-E-L. You just say them in sequence, you'll never get it wrong.
All right, there you go.
That's a cool R-E-L. Rule. Yeah, see?
Thanks for coming down, dude. I will see you again shortly, I'm sure. Happy 4th of July, people. Thank you for listening to our show. Jay, thanks for subbing for Zach.
Sorry about the beginning. Hope you have it.
Hey, man.
Cleans up
well,
nice.
No, we'll dive in. We'll dive in somewhere. Sorry. We'll dive in somewhere that's appropriate. Only the live people will deal with that. The rest of the people, like, never, like, nothing ever happens.
Sounds good.
Bye, everybody. Happy 4th of July.
Bye, everyone.